The Rainbow Bridge: Reflections on Interdisciplinarity in the Cybernetic Age by Roger Griffin. A visitor to rural China at the height of the Cultural Revolution might have encountered a strange spectacle. Rows of citizens, some only recently torn out of privileged urban professions, stood in fields banging pots and pans with the aim of repeatedly scaring sparrows into flight until they dropped dead with exhaustion. They were following a directive issued by none other than Chairman Mao Zedong himself, aimed at ridding the newly born socialist nation of the four harms, or natural plagues. These were decreed to be rats, flies, mosquitoes, and sparrows, all accused of destroying the crops, and as such now declared a demonized enemy within of the natural world to be ruthlessly exterminated. A truce with the sparrow was only called once even the most fanatical Maoists acknowledged that the avian genocide had allowed locusts and other vermin to multiply unchecked. As a result, they were now devastating even greater quantities of agricultural produce than before, thus aggravating rather than relieving the famines then ravaging broad swathes of the country. It is an episode that can be cited to illustrate several points, such as the grotesque absurdities that arise when urbanized male elites undertake totalizing utopian projects of social transformation with no regard for the cycles and symbioses of organic processes, or to illustrate the woeful neglect in Marxist thinking of the ecological base of societal existence, or even the cataclysmic change that can occur when the tsunami of modernity breaks over traditional rural society and overrides the accumulated wisdom of millennia. In the present context, however, it is meant to offer a graphic illustration of the pitfall of reductionist as opposed to holistic thinking whenever attempts are made to radically change a dynamic system which hosts high levels of synergy between its component parts. It is particularly appropriate that Wiley Compass, the pioneers of virtual publishing designed to break down national, cultural and economic barriers hindering the dissemination of knowledge, should now be experimenting with the viability of the virtual conference, something which offers the prospect of combining a truly global participation and interaction across disciplinary and economic boundaries with a minimal ecological footprint. What makes this undertaking even more groundbreaking is that it has chosen as the topic for this first conference to focus on breaking down disciplinary barriers. In the process, it is freeing up minds for the type of synergic thinking between different specialisms that would never treat the destruction of crops as a monocausal event, let alone resort to such a simplistic, totalitarian, biocidal solution. In short, this conference is using the net to promote what one of the most innovative and influential pioneers in this field, Frederick Wester, called networked thinking, or in his native German, Vernetztes Denken. Frederick Wester was the incarnation of post-war interdisciplinarity. Having studied chemistry at the universities of Mainz and Paris and taught at the Max Planck Institute, in 1970 he founded the private Munich-based think tank the Studiengruppe für Biologie und Umwelt, or the Study Group for Biology and the Environment. He went on to become professor at the Bundeswehr University in Munich and to teach applied economics at the Hochschule in St. Gallen. In the course of holding these various posts, he refined a sophisticated way of thinking about complex systems in what he dubbed the cybernetic age. This he fruitfully applied to such subjects as the logistics of movement in large conurbations, mass urban transport systems, the stress induced by modernity, education for the complexities of a globalized existence, and perhaps the ultimate science where networked thinking is vital to understanding ecology. He had a major impact on the newly formed Green Party in Germany, which made Vernetztes Denken into a founding principle of its manifesto. He also bequeathed two cybernetic games, Ecolopoly and Ecopolicy, designed to train players in the habits of holistic thinking about environmental issues so vital to understanding the interconnectedness of all living systems. Wester's whole academic life was thus dedicated to smashing glass walls and ceilings separating different academic disciplines in the natural and social sciences. By undertaking this in a spirit which combined scientific and technical expertise with a passionate humanism, he opened up possibilities for conceptualizing modernization and globalization in a way that encourages radically new solutions to be found to the urgent problems these processes increasingly pose, not just for the quality, but for the very viability and sustainability of urban civilization in the imminent future. No doubt he would have had penetrating insights to offer about the current structural crisis of the fundamental institutions of capitalism. He would certainly have been an ideal virtual keynote speaker for this conference, which can be seen as a call for the cognitive energies that flow from networked thinking to be transfused deep into the heart of the human sciences so as to make them genuinely life-enhancing. In the heady days when Western intellectual space was curved by the impact of the hippie rebellion against straight society, some major sociologists and ecologists, notably Theodor Rozsack and Fritjof Capra, succumbed to the enticing delusion that a new day in the history of human knowledge was dawning. In this new age of enlightenment, the sclerosis that stemmed from always thinking within disciplinary boxes, which left women, children, poetry, mystic experience, passion, and the planet itself out of account, would give way to one of yogic interconnectedness. In Blakean terms, single vision would cede its crown to fourfold vision in a paradigm shift which would allow reductionist science to become redemptive gnosis, with the result that humankind would once again see through and not just with the eye. The conspicuous lack of a paradigm shift to date, despite the mounting evidence of the present system's unsustainability, makes it important to prevent the sirens of millenarian fantasies from raising unrealistic hopes that breaking down disciplinary barriers is a benign act of tearing down barricades, barring the entrance to an earthly utopia. Instead, we need to postulate a more pragmatic model of how knowledge progresses in those societies where ritual-bound cosmologies have disintegrated enough to foster human inquiry by small elites into how things really are through what we call scientific inquiry. The close examination of major episodes in the history of science provided by such books as Arthur Koestler's The Sleepwalkers and Richard Holmes' The Age of Wonder suggests that in every age, science has had its technicians who specialize in acquiring, applying, and transmitting to a new generation the knowledge organized securely within the disciplinary paradigms and compartments inherited from the past. It has also had a minority of outstandingly creative thinkers, often treated as geniuses, mavericks, or even mad at the time, whose energy is directed to challenging the conventional paradigms of the discipline. Such works also highlight the fact that those special individuals who break new ground are frequently driven by idiosyncratic passions and obsessions and operate under the influence of private cosmologies, which are eccentric blends of science and myth, fact and fantasy, calling into question established notions of scientific rationality. Certainly, we have to abandon any assumption that knowledge progresses in a straight line from myth-bound ignorance and superstition to empirically tested truth in a series of groundbreaking and barrier-smashing leaps. The European Renaissance was a sustained period of spectacular expansion in most areas of knowledge, one which laid the basis of the modern human and natural sciences. The prelude to the rise of specialist disciplines was a period of extraordinary transdisciplinarity embodied in such gifted individuals as Marsilio Ficini, Pico della Mirandola, and Leonardo da Vinci. But this was arguably not because rigid disciplinary barriers were deliberately broken down. Rather, a productive relationship grew up, nourished by an increasingly jarring cognitive dissonance between Christian and pagan scientific cosmologies, between two contradictory trajectories. One was a drive towards specialization, the development of ever more tightly focused empirical method to resolve specific technological and scientific problems, and the emergence of properly demarcated and patrolled disciplinary barriers. The other was towards extravagant flights of speculation. This was fed by the compulsive need to restore the European sacred canopy that was showing its first signs of being eroded by secular rationalist thought. It was also fueled by newly rediscovered occultist and mystical traditions of antiquity, for which it was axiomatic that spirit and matter, inner and outer, the divine and the profane, the microcosm and the macrocosm, were intimately connected. Thus, while Galileo focused on the problem of the mathematics of the pendulum, he did so serene in the certainty that all the patterns and laws that came to light or could be formulated mathematically originated in the mind of God, since philosophy is written in this grand book, the universe. It is written in the language of mathematics, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometric figures. Inevitably, then, the European society that produced Nicolaus Copernicus, Giordano Bruno, Leonardo da Vinci, Francis Bacon, and Isaac Newton also produced innumerable scholars trapped within the traditional theologically or classically based paradigms of the day, and content to zealously patrol narrow disciplinary frontiers laid down in the universities and academies. The Enlightenment age is no less paradoxical. A pivotal period for the emergence of professionalized and rationalized disciplines of human inquiry, it also gave rise to the powerful pre-Romantic rebellions against reductionist thinking in such figures as William Blake and Wolfgang Goethe. Their dissenting voices were closely followed by Romantic thinkers who chose the medium of philosophy and poetry and painting to attack the blinkeredness of the increasingly mechanistic and secularized vision of reality being propagated within professionalized disciplines housed in increasingly secularized universities. Then, just when the future of Western science seemed to be heading towards the triumph of Newtonian and eventually positivist Kantian paradigms, which promised to make every aspect of the world in principle accessible to human understanding, they were radically subverted by spectacular developments in psychology, subatomic physics, mathematics, non-Euclidean geometry, and counterintuitive epistemology pioneered by such figures as Freud, Einstein, and Heisenberg. Such developments underscored the pivotal role played, often subliminally, by active human invention and imagination in all scientific discovery. On this point, it was Einstein himself who observed, "Physical concepts are free creations of the human mind and are not, however it may seem, uniquely determined by the external world. In our endeavour to understand reality, we are somewhat like a man trying to understand the mechanism of a closed watch. He sees the face and the moving hands, even hears it ticking, but he has no way of opening the case. If he is ingenious, he may form some picture of the mechanism, which could be responsible for all the things he observes, but he may never be quite sure his picture is the only one which could explain his observations. He will never be able to compare his picture with the real mechanism, and he cannot even imagine the possibility of the meaning of such a comparison." Given the essential mismatch between the human cognitive faculties and the manifold realities in which it is immersed, it is clear that we, i.e. all those involved in the production and dissemination of knowledge, need to sustain a paradoxical mindset when we engage with our infinitesimally small nook or cranny of empirical reality within an infinitely vast and ultimately unknowable universe. First, we must retain and respect, if only methodologically, the artificial barriers erected between disciplines in order to achieve and transmit definite knowledge which meets recognized standards of peer review and international criteria of sound scholarship. True to Goethe's dictum that only within limitations can mastery be revealed, all scholars who seek not just to duplicate but create knowledge have to be able to work within conventionally demarcated specialisms. At the same time, we must remain conscious of the intrinsically semi-permeable membranes that exist between disciplines when tackling certain big questions, or seeking to model the processes involved in particularly complex phenomena or dynamic systems. In practice, this means that, just as a child's game of armies requires both soldiers and generals, so progress in the natural and human sciences demands the presence of a majority of technicians energetically applying the received paradigms in every specialist area, and a minority of mavericks, lateral thinkers, whose own research leads them to modify or change the hegemonic paradigm at the risk of being proved wrong. Of course, in reality, the same scientist, human or natural, can operate as technician or maverick according to circumstances. At the level of individual research projects, that means knowing when to be a soldier and when to be a general. Another way of putting the same proposition is that the history of the growth in knowledge involves an ongoing process of erecting barriers to define specialist areas of research and the paradigms they subsume. At the same time, other countervailing developments are at work, tending to break the same barriers down. These are based on a receptivity to transdisciplinary synergies that suddenly can come into view as so-called knowledges. By the way, I'm glad Microsoft Word's inbuilt dictionary still flags this up as a non-word. New knowledges emerge in other disciplines, or certain established paradigms they host suddenly take on an unexpected relevance. Thus, each field of inquiry needs splitters who emphasize the uniqueness of phenomena and resist their subsumption within generic concepts, generic models, or overarching theories, and are temperamentally suspicious of collaborative transdisciplinary projects as threatening the integrity of their specialism or discipline. Such people are the source of much invaluable data. But it simultaneously needs lumpers who strive to locate specific and, in the human sphere, unique phenomena within generic categories and processes. Of course, it makes for progress if academics can operate flexibly as both splitters and lumpers according to the situation. At the moment, I am in full lumping mode, for example, because the theme of the conference focuses on the need for lumping. However, if I am called upon to analyse a particular primary text or movement that falls within my specialism, fascist studies, I revert to being a splitter once more. By now, the reader or listener may well be craving empirical flesh to be put on the abstract bones of speculative analysis which I have treated him or her to so far. Were my field of specialism the intrinsically transdisciplinary ones of astrophysics or neuroscience, I have no doubt that I would be able to offer the listeners a smorgasbord of delicious morsels to illustrate how central breaking barriers is to advancing empirical understanding of the outer and inner universe respectively. However, I must turn, for examples, to my own area of expertise, which is fascist studies. For decades, comparative fascist studies, at least outside the Marxist camp, were regarded by outsiders as quicksands liable to suck down any unsuspecting historian who strayed onto them from the terra firma of conventional historiographical topics, such as the biography of Mussolini or the collapse of Weimar. Fascism, as a generic term, was widely regarded as a conundrum, as having, to quote one rather well-known English philosopher, the form of an ideology without the content, whatever that means, as reducible to negatives such as its alleged rejection of communism, socialism, liberalism, feminism, rationality, culture, modernity, or humanism. Another approach was to see fascism as the expression of the power lust of psychopathological charismatic dictators such as Hitler and Mussolini. Since the 1990s, however, ever more academics are prepared to concede that fascism did in fact have an ideology. True, this was no rationally constructed ideology in the Enlightenment tradition. Rather, its discourse was shaped by deeply held convictions based on a mythically structured universe of dichotomies. Decadence and rebirth, degeneracy and heroism, weakness and strength, health and corruption, social fragmentation and the new national community rising from the ashes of decadence like a phoenix. This convergence between academics in recognizing the, what was to its followers, positive dimension of the appeal of fascism has coincided with exciting new approaches to terms which had for decades languished in a state where they were either applied in isolation or ignored altogether as heuristically useless for historiographical research into the history of individual fascisms. Concepts such as modernity, totalitarianism, political religion, charisma, modernism, once generally regarded as unconnected or contradictory, started to be used as complementary. At the same time, phenomena such as eugenics, biopolitics, genocidal racism, and the quest to create a new man, whether in the form of modern Romans or reborn Aryans, cease to be seen as the hallmark of particular regimes or the fruit of a special path to nationhood or modernity. Instead, they came to be understood as generic phenomena, bound up not with a particular national culture, but with attempts to create an alternative, more viable modernity to solve the crisis of the liberal rational model of progress. Such projects made particular sense during the years of the perceived collapse of liberal capitalist civilization in the wake of the First World War. As a result, many academics have moved over the last few years from the mutually exclusive use of terms to seeing them as part of a cluster. The fascist regime, for example, is increasingly recognized as driven not by Mussolini's megalomania or by the bid of capitalism to stave off a socialist revolution, but by a loose alliance of various currents of utopianism within Italian society that aspire to create a new Italian society and a new type of Italian. At that point, it can be illuminated by a whole set of generic terms previously used as alternatives, but now seen as existing in a synergic relationship to one another. Thus, Emilio Gentile, Italy's most important expert on fascism, has created a syncretic definition of totalitarianism that relates its attempted conquest of society and monopoly of power to such elements as a revolutionary experiment in political domination, and the integral politicization of existence, and to the myths and the values of a palingenetic ideology, by which he means an ideology which is centered on the myth of imminent rebirth from decadence. According to this definition, the coercive state of totalitarianism does not aim at the monopoly of power for its own sake. Rather, it is to be seen as the attempt to use a blend of social control and political religion to bring about an anthropological revolution, the creation of a new man and a new civilization. This approach to totalitarianism, which brings in elements from comparative sociology, comparative politics, comparative religion, and comparative history, is profoundly complementary to my own definition of fascism. This definition stresses the centrality of palingenetic myth, the myth of regeneration, the myth of rebirth, which I published in 1991 in my The Nature of Fascism. More recently, in Modernism and Fascism, I have also shown at length how compatible such an approach is with an extended definition of modernism, which turns it into a term which embraces socio-political phenomena and highlights the impulse to create a new society and an alternative modernity. Recognizing fascism as a form of political modernism is in turn consistent with David Roberts' major work stressing the drive behind totalitarian regimes to become a gardening state which will produce the ideal society, in some cases regardless of the cost in human suffering and destruction such a project involves. It also breaks down the artificial barriers separating the history of art and architecture from the history of politics, which led to futurism being seen as unpolitical despite its support of fascism in Italy, and Ezra Pound's support for Mussolini being treated as a riddle on the assumption that modernist art and right-wing political experimentation were somehow incompatible. By breaking down definitional boundaries between such key terms as totalitarian, political religion, and modernism, new vistas open up which reveal subterranean links between such apparently unconnected phenomena as the cult of sport, the cult of the body, the cult of nature, youth, and health, modernist architecture, expressionist dance, eugenics, biopolitics, spectacular politics, charismatic leadership, state terror, genocide, primordial revitalization ceremonies, and the innate human tendency to create utopias of heavenly purity and beauty, whose realization so often produces hell on earth. Such a transdisciplinary perspective on fascism makes it easier to empathize with the passionate plea which one Red Cross bureaucrat who visited Auschwitz at the height of its destruction of human beings made to the highly respected BBC journalist and humanist John Simpson. He tried to open his mind to the idealism, even of the Commandant Rudolf Höss, which lay behind the Taylorist mass production of death in the camp. He said, These people were proud of their work. They were convinced of being engaged in an act of purification. They called Auschwitz the anus of Europe. Europe had to be cleansed. They were responsible for the purification of Europe. If you cannot get your head round that, you will understand nothing at all. The humanistic imagination naturally tends to falter in confronting the boundless capacity for destructiveness and systemic cruelty of fellow human beings joined together by an ideology to act as a community of faith whose psychological coherence depends on the demonization of the mythic enemy and hence its ritual destruction. In my specialism, which embraces several of the most destructive isms of modern history, breaking down disciplinary barriers is the precondition to breaking down even more heavily fortified psychological defences that prevent historians and social scientists from applying empathetic understanding to their fellow human beings when they are acting in a revolutionary or purging mode. Used judiciously, interdisciplinarity can enable us to get our heads and hearts round just how wonderfully creative and yet how terrifyingly destructive Homo sapiens can be. It helps us realise how tragically beautiful life on our lonely planet can appear. At that point, the human sciences help to build what E.M. Forster in Howards End calls the Rainbow Bridge. The Rainbow Bridge that should connect the prose in us with the passion. Without it, we are meaningless fragments, half monks, half beasts, unconnected arches that have never joined into a man. With it, love is born, and alights on the highest curve, glowing against the grey, sober against the fire. Happy the man who sees from either aspect the glory of these outspread wings. The roads of his soul lie clear, and he and his friends shall find easy going. By seeking to erect such a bridge in academia, by operating assiduously centripetally within delimited disciplines, but always intent on connecting up centrifugally and creatively with neighbouring specialisms and specialists, by thinking both small and big, locally and globally, scholars and researchers in the human sciences can more easily transcend the dichotomy between beast and monk. Concern about the many human predicaments, suffused with the joy of discovery, of connecting, of teaching, can then inform our work more powerfully. And the enigmas, tragedies, and triumphs of the history of our species, exquisite and horrifying, can reveal themselves more fully. We would then penetrate to the heart of William Blake's cryptic pronouncement. How do you know, but every bird that cuts the airy way is an immense world of delight, closed by your senses five. Certainly the glory of the outspread spiritual and cognitive wings that Forster refers to, once perceived or intuited through a consciousness expanded beyond man-made and woman-made, arbitrary disciplinary barriers, has the potential to revitalize our lives, both academic and personal. It should also act as an effective deterrent to slaughtering sparrows.